Buenos días, damas y caballeros, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. My name is Daniel Rodriguez. I'm a professor of missions here at Pepperdine University, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to Pepperdine University and to the Pepperdine Bible Lectures. I do want to apologize, first and foremost, for the weather. It's normally a lot nicer than this, but bear with us. We're not going to get any snow. We're not going to get any lightning. No fires or floods. It should be wonderful for your visit today. And I just also want to thank you for being here for this class. This is the second in a series of six classes that's focused on Hispanic ministry in the United States. And I'm very excited that this morning my brother Scott Emery with Great Cities Ministry is here to speak to us about reaching a new generation of Latino immigrants. Take a look at your booklet. You'll see that we have four more classes, two more tomorrow morning at 8:30 and 9:30, and then two more on Friday morning at 8:30 and 9:30, all of them in this class, all of them focus on Hispanic ministry, but on very different aspects of Hispanic ministry, because one of the things we want you to understand is that one size does not fit all. And so without taking any more of my brother Scott's time, I want to just welcome Scott. Thank you for coming, Pepperdine Scott, and let's welcome our speaker this morning.
Thank you very much. I appreciate you guys being here this morning. I know a lot of you guys were here in the first session with Dan, and I imagine we'll might see each other hopefully most mornings the next couple of days. I think every morning at 8:30 and then at 9:30 the next two mornings is when we have this track continues. So it should be easy to remember, and I hope we see a lot of you guys here again. It looks like we could almost do this in Spanish today. I don't know. Most of us are Spanish speakers, it looks like. I speak a little bit of Spanish. Pero un poquito.
Te defiendes bien, hermano.
Yeah, I made a defense. That's right. I defend myself. That's about all I can say for that. I'll tell you a little bit about myself here in a second so you understand why I'm standing before you. But I do want to say, refute one thing that Dan said earlier. He said, you know, or not refuted, but maybe redirected. He said, not all Latinos eat tacos. And that's true. But all Texans, we do.
Okay.
All Tejanos, we eat tacos and burritos and fajitas and all the other things that we call Tex-Mex and really enjoy that. So I'm glad you guys are here this morning. I will be speaking about reaching a new generation of Latino immigrants. And like Dan said, there's no competition between Dan and I. You know, we do Great Cities Missions as we tend to focus on first-generation Spanish-speaking Hispanic community. But I'm a big proponent of what Dan is talking about the second, third, and so on generations that are English-dominant. And I think, and we'll talk about this some later in this presentation, I think there's definitely some ways where those things mesh. They're not mutually exclusive. It's not either or. I think there's a lot of room for both and Dan touched on some of that, and we'll talk about more about that as we go through this morning in my presentation. Just real quick, I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself, because I know you're not here to learn about me, but I want you to understand why I'm here and what my background is. Dan's pedigree is irrefutable, being his credentials, but mine maybe not so much. So I do work for Great Cities Missions, an organization that was launched by a team out of ACU in 1961. In 76, they went back to the States. A couple of their team members did because they saw the great need to recruit more teams to reach Brazil. So they came back and started Brazil Breakthrough in 1976, which in 79 became Continent of Great Cities. Maybe some of you knew us under that name, which we used for many, many years, and many people still call us that, which is fine. In 79, because they expanded into Spanish-speaking countries and started doing teams and church-planting teams in those countries as well. And then in 2010 became Great Cities Missions because the continent part before is because we exclusively focused on South America, but we were increasingly doing things in Central America, Spanish-speaking Caribbean, and even in the U.S., which is my particular area of responsibility. And so they changed the name, they dropped the continent and called it Great Cities Missions. Placed over 30 church-planting teams in more than 10 different Latin American countries so far. A lot of those are North American teams, gringos who's been sent down, like the team I was on that went to Santiago, Chile, in 1999, but now about 75% of our work is done with Latin American teams that are, a lot of them come out of Baxter Institute in Honduras that we work with closely. We do team recruitment, assessment, and training. We do ongoing team care and coaching for the full life cycle of their work, from the time they launch, the time they are, if they're from the United States, if they're repatriated, or if they're from Central America and go to Colombia, we want to also help them return well to Central America, to their home country, if they choose to do so. And we do a lot of support and consulting for sponsoring churches. I grew up in Fort Worth, Texas, graduated from Texas A&M. Whoop!
Yep. The Aggies. Big Aggies.
And also in this neighborhood, Azusa Pacific. I know it's Free Methodist, but I hope that's okay. I did it as a remotely from Santiago. They had a program there, and I did a master's in organizational leadership at Azusa Pacific, or through Azusa Pacific. I was part of a church planting team in Santiago, Chile for 14 years, 99 to 2013. Joined the GCM staff when I came back from that time, and I've been married for 20 years and have two kids. And my wife hopefully will be here. She sent me a text saying she's running late. I know that's unusual for...
She's a Latino.
Yeah, she's very Latina. She's Latina. No, she's not Latino. She's Latina. We have two, again, my area of responsibility is U.S. Hispanic Works, and our work, I inherited these when I started at Great Cities. They're already ongoing, was Siempre Familia in Fort Worth and Arlington. I worked in Arlington in, this was part of the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex. It's the third largest city in that Metroplex. And we're currently seeking new U.S. projects, have some things in the works, but so far none of those have come to complete fruition, but we're still pushing those forward. By the way, there's some material at the back of the room. When you leave, if you want to pick it up, you're welcome to. And one of those things is the latest Christian Chronicle, which has an article about the Arlington church plant, the Hispanic church plant there that we are working with. It's a really good article about the team there and some other things that are going on in U.S. Hispanic work through Jim Hallway, with LAMP and other things like that. Okay, let's get into the more, a little bit more of the meat of the presentation. Enough about me. Your pop quiz. Here are the answers to your pop quiz if you chose to try and do that. And just for fun, just for interest. And I'll go through these pretty quickly because what I really want to get to is more towards the is further down in the slideshow and the slide presentation. So I just want to give you some background information. And the reason I have these statistics up here, and I know Dan's covered some of this already, is I think we have a lot of misconceptions in the United States about the Hispanic population. We're maybe unaware, misconceptions and ignorance, and the fact that we're unaware of some of the tendencies, the trends, the statistics, the demographics. And so just to kind of give us a foundation for understanding better what we're looking at, we have some of these figures. Now, like you probably saw on Dan's slide, which were much better cited than mine are, there's a hodgepodge of statistics because there are so many different studies. They were done at different times. There are hard statistics. There are projections. Sometimes they're not always the same. You look at one study and it says 1 year or one number, and you look at another study and it says something slightly different. So just bear with us if you see a little bit of inconsistency between Dan and mine or even within my own. It's because of there's just different, so many different sources for information, and you kind of have to glean, go through it and try and glean what you want out of it. And a lot of times, some of the confusion comes in these studies, quite frankly, because a lot of it is self-reporting. The census stuff, even if whether or not you're Hispanic at all, is if you choose to call yourself Hispanic. So some people may choose to do that, and we may think, well, that's an accurate assessment of that person. Some people may not choose to describe themselves as Hispanic, and we think, well, to me, you seem like you're Hispanic. If I were to meet you, I would just call you Hispanic. But they don't maybe self-report that way. And so lots of things, there could be some discrepancies. But overall, I would say that I think it's pretty accurate. It's accurate enough to base some theories on and some strategies on for our use. So that's some of the things that go on in the numbers. 54 million is the more or less present number of Hispanics in the United States, which is about 17% of the U.S. population. I think Dan said 16%. So again, you see where the numbers are a little fudged a little bit. This is one that you do see a lot that's different. I think Dan said 2060. I came across the study said 2050. And definitely, if there's a discrepancy, Dan's probably right. I'll say that. He's probably got the more accurate information. He's much more an academic, true academic than I am, so I would lean towards him. But at any rate, by 2050 or 2060, the U.S. Hispanic population is going to be huge. Bigger. It's already huge. It's going to be even bigger and a great percentage of our U.S. population. The United States ranks second among nations for Hispanic population, and the U.S. minority, the Hispanic minority group, as a minority group, is the biggest minority group in the United States. There are 22 states out of almost half of our states in the United States, their biggest minority group are Hispanics. Also, biggest immigrant group in the United States at number one, and 38 states is their biggest immigrant population is Hispanic population. And there are 8 states with a Hispanic population of 1 million plus, which is a funny figure because they're highly concentrated if you talk about 54 million folks in the Hispanic population, and there are only 8 states with 1 million plus, that means there are some of those states who have a lot more. The plus is big. There's a lot more than 1 million in some of those states, and we'll talk about that. 12 million is approximately the number of Hispanic households in the U.S., and this is an interesting figure, and there are a lot of other studies in financial areas and marketing that talk more about this. $1.4 trillion is their estimated U.S. buying power in the United States. So not at all insignificant. And you probably have all seen that, especially if you're living in an area where there is a high concentration of Hispanics and Hispanic communities. That's my case in Dallas-Fort Worth, no doubt here in Southern California. That's the case. You see all kinds of marketing to the Hispanic population, and you see, I think more than that, it's increasing at a very rapid rate, the amount of marketing you see to the Hispanic community. And, quite frankly, one thing that's caught my attention since I came back from Chile 2 years ago is the number of bilingual advertisements you see on TV, which is what Dan's talking about. The Wall Street and the marketers are recognizing the powerful and the potential of that market of those English and Latinos that speak Spanglish, you know, and have that mix of cultures. And they're going. I've seen half a dozen commercials on the last 6 months that there's mainly in English, and all of a sudden they're throwing a little bit of Spanish here and there. You know, just kind of. There's one. There's a guy talking. I think an insurance guy's talking on telephone, and he's going back and forth in Spanglish.
Radio station in LA.
Yeah, he's going back and forth in Spanish on the telephone, talking to a family member or something about insurance, and so that's pretty interesting. So, how did you guys do on the quiz? If you did the quiz, did some of you do pretty well? Anybody get them all right or all, approximately all right? Yeah. No. You got them all right? Because I got a prize.
All right.
I got a prize. You can't, I'm going to throw it to you. I know it's very un-Hispanic to throw things, right? Well, we're going to get to that in a second. Here we go. I'm going to throw it because you didn't look like you were ready to catch. I learned in Chile, we always got in trouble for being gringos and we like to throw things. Gringos like to throw things. We throw bread. You know, it's, hey, give me a roll. There you go. And the Chilean's like, oh, don't hit him on the
Don't throw Bibles.
Don't throw stuff. And they can't catch either, so just hit them in the chest. They say, if you kick it to me, I'll be okay. You know? Don't throw it to me.
Especially to a woman.
And I say that, and I grew up playing soccer. I'm a rare gringo from Texas. I grew up playing soccer since I was 7 years old. So I played my whole life. And my son is on a team in Irving, Texas, where we live. And he's the only bolillo on the team. And they call him that. So. And he didn't know that term coming from Chile, so they first said they were calling him Bolillo, and he was standing there looking at the coach like, who are you talking to? He's completely fluent in Spanish, but he was like, he didn't know that slang, so he was like, who are you looking at? He's looking around. Who's he talking to? So there's just a quick graphic of the trend. You see how rapidly it's grown, the U.S. Hispanic population from 1970, 9.1 million, to just skyrocketed in only 40 years' time to 54 million is, and that curve is continuing to climb at a very steep rate. Here's your answer to the bonus question, the top five states. This is what we talked about, the concentration of the Hispanic community in only a few states, the large number of them in only a few states. Of course, California is one of the few respects where California beats Texas in something. Texas usually beats California in lots of other things, but you have more Hispanics in California than we do in Texas. I don't know. I think we're growing. Yeah, we're trying to catch up to you.
Especially in the Metroplex.
But a lot of these, I like this slide because these slides, like Dan said, Barna, Pew, census data. I think this one is from, this is Barna or is this Pew? One of two, I forget. But they're very, very good studies. I think the study that you have to pay for from Barna is $25. I mean, it's worth every penny of that and much more. And you can download PDF or you can have them sent to you by mail. But I like this slide because a lot of people who aren't familiar with this, with these demographics, with these numbers, are very surprised by the states that have the most Hispanic population. They're not surprised by California, Texas, or Florida. Not quite as much by New York, sometimes, but Illinois, I think, usually a lot of times surprises people. They don't realize how dominant, especially around Chicago, that the Hispanic population, that so much so that Illinois would be one of the top five states for Hispanic population. Did anybody get those right? Get the five? Did you even attempt it?
Right.
Yeah, I guess they got it right.
Because I got a couple more stress balls.
When you work in Hispanic ministry, you have stress balls because you get a lot of stress.
I just went through all the border states and I only got three right.
Did anybody else get them all right? Yeah?
You got two
right? Well, that's good enough. You know, Paul. I don't want to take them back home, so I don't want to take them back home. Here you go.
Reduce stress.
That's right, reduce stress. And here's a quick, and Dan touched on some of this too, but just again, quick, because... And of course, a lot of people would identify with this quadrant here saying, oh yeah, the Mexican population is by far the largest. And it is. But sometimes they're surprised and are unaware of how large some of the other groups are. And as Dan said, those groups are increasing increasing at a more rapid rate in some instances in the Mexican population because there were the waves that were very, 97%, Mexican that were immigrating to the States. But more and more and more over time, you have folks coming from Central America and even South America. Chileans don't make this list, I don't think. So we don't have many Chileans here. I know there's a big population of Chileans in Toronto, Canada. In fact, some of our best friends, when we first made friends in Chile, good family. We did lots of things with them, barbecues, you know, asados, and just had a lot of fun with them. And then they up and moved to Canada, to Toronto, Canada. I was like, Toronto, Canada, of all things. Is oh, there's quite a population of immigrants, Chilean immigrants in Toronto, Canada. So it was interesting. And then I saw these little things, kind of like a little paper that newspaper you get for free. It's called Dato Avisos. And on the back, there are all these postage stamp size ads. And there are all kinds of things in there, lawyers and things like that. But a lot of them were immigration attorneys. And almost all of them were advertising, I'll help you get to Canada. And so they were all over, peppered all over this ad. And the reason Canada was looking for Chileans tend to be very well educated. They had a good economy for a long time, a pretty good education system compared to some countries. And so a lot of very qualified professionals, engineers, tech people, financial people. And so Canada was saying, hey, we want you to come with those professional skills and come help us populate Canada, because Canada still has a population issue, underpopulated in some areas. And so they were trying to attract Chileans to go to Canada. Okay, so other quick statistics about the... And again, some of these two are mixed also, because it's kind of hard to find a lot of information that just says just the immigrant population versus just the native-born population that Dan was talking about. You have foreign-born, in our case, which can be confusing sometimes, as Dan was pointing out. But when we say foreign-born in this context, we mean those who are born in Mexico or Central America and have come to the United States, versus native-born being born in the United States. So sometimes it's hard to find statistics that divide those groups out. They're oftentimes, more often than not, they're mixed in the census data and the study data. They're mixed together. So sometimes you can't always separate those two. But this is kind of thing, if you came across, a Hispanic person in the street and just met them, and this is kind of the average Hispanic person by the numbers. Now, by the numbers, obviously I don't want to throw everybody into one boat, and it's not a homogenous group by any means, as Dan pointed out as well. But if you had the average Hispanic person that lives in the United States, here's what they look like by the numbers. More than 50% of them would have these characteristics. About split half and half male and female. It's not always been that way. That statistic has changed over time, back and forth, but currently it's about half and half. As Dan was saying, most of them were born in the United States, and most of them would be of Mexican origin, as we've already seen, and over half of them would live in Texas, California, Florida. Even taking New York and Illinois out of the equation, most of them would live in those three states, over half. Most, as Dan was saying, they're young, under 30. Many of them, more than we realize, are monolingual. And that could be they're monolingual either in English or they're monolingual in Spanish. But the majority are monolingual, not bilingual. And again, this a lot of this is self-reporting. So you'll see even in this list a little bit of some contradiction in some of the numbers, or what seem to be contradiction in the numbers. Speak Spanish in the home, 74%. Speak English at least well, 74%. So those are interesting numbers that seem, at first look, seem a little counterintuitive and seem to contradict each other a little bit. Again, some of that might be because of the self-reporting. Do they speak English well? Do they speak Spanish in the home? Well, they're the ones saying they speak it well, or they speak at the home or not. So, we're not 100% sure. A young population, so a lot of them aren't married. But most of them do live in a household headed by a married couple, by a mother and father who are married. Has a child under 18. Over half of the families, or the half of the people, have a child under 18. Again, young population. Again, this is one that sometimes may be counterintuitive. People who don't know the numbers, most of them are employed and most of them are insured. We tend to be in the political debate. It gets thrown out there that they want to take advantage of, they're not insured and they're not employed and they're trying to take advantage of a welfare state and things like this. And that's rhetoric, that's political rhetoric. But the truth is that most are employed and most are insured. Now, there's still a lot who aren't. But that's true of not only the Hispanic population, but other ethnic groups or nationalities as well. Household income. If you took everybody together, their household income averages $39,500. Individual incomes would average around $21,000. Most of them rent. Most of them have a high school diploma or better. Did not vote in the last election, so they're not, as a whole, not largely politically involved. Obviously, that's something, again, that they're trying to want to see change in that and expecting change in that. And definitely this election coming is going to focus, those politicians will be largely focused on this group and trying to up that number in the ones that participate in elections. Is politically conservative or moderate? Is 63%. Again, self-reporting. Professes the Catholic faith, over half. Has the Bible, almost 90%. But did not attend church last week. Well over half did not attend a church last week. Though 85% would say that religion is somewhat or very important in their life. So that's a figure we're going to talk a little bit more about in a moment. So what I want to talk about a little bit as the time we have remaining, which we go to, what time we go to?
10:15.
10:15. Is some of the what I would identify as areas of opportunity in among this population based on some of those numbers and just based on some of anecdotal experience as I talk to the guys who are in Hispanic ministry and observe what's going on. I think there's some great areas of opportunity that as we go forward and hopefully do more to reach this community and through a variety of ways, whether it be planting, you know, we plant churches with teams. That's one way we do it at Great Cities Missions. There are other ways. There's six, though, who's here in our audience. We'll talk a bit later about how they do it in their ministry. Hyphen Initiative with Hector and Dan, who works with that. We'll talk about ways that they try to reach English-dominant Latinos and the ways that they might do those things. And there are other ministries out there. Our sister in the back who has her ministry that's working with, especially with women in Hispanic ministry, Michelle Goff. And these things are great. And we need to be doing all of it because the numbers, there's no need to be territorialistic by any means or competitive. Because there, as you can see by the numbers, there are a lot of people in the U.S. and outside the U.S., of course, as well. But inside the U.S., there are so many folks who need to be reached. There are so many different communities that are large pockets of folks in the Hispanic community. And we can't cover them all. No one ministry definitely could cover them all. No one university is going to cover them all. The only way we're going to cover it all, and we're not even going to do that, really, but is working together is the only way we're going to have a chance to even attempt to cover it all the opportunity that's there. So these are some areas of opportunity. I see if you plant a team or send a guy out to minister to this community and try to reach this community, I think there's some specific areas that the numbers cry out for that are areas of opportunity that could be exploited and have a lot of potential. I think one is just in the area of faith and religion. We've seen that they, as a group, as a demographic group, they self-report as being religious or spiritual. But then with the flip side of that, though, we see low involvement in churches and faith communities. So there is, I think, right there, we have a great advantage. We're not trying to convert somebody from Buddhism or from Hinduism or from the unbelievers or atheists. We're not, in the large part, we have a great advantage. They're already believers, mm-hmm. right? So that's a huge, huge advantage. We can't take that for granted. We have to really use that to our advantage, exploit that in the good sense of the word to our advantage. Because 83% of Hispanics claim some kind of religious affiliation. And here's where we see some division, and I want to talk about this, what this may mean to us. You see some division between the foreign-born and the native-born. 9% foreign-born are religiously unaffiliated, while twice as many, 20% of native-born self-report as being religiously unaffiliated. So, and I think you see this in other numbers, I think as you go down the generations, as you come from the immigrant generation, the first generation, largely Spanish-speaking, monolingual generation, as they go down the successive generations, they distance themselves further from the church and from religion. Which is one area I'd say that's an important reason why we need to go after those immigrants as they come in before their kids and grandkids and great-grandkids move further and further away from the church and from the faith community. Because as we know, it'd be easier if they're already self-reporting as religious and involved and have been involved, and definitely have been uprooted. So if they were involved as immigrants, have they gotten re-engaged in the United States in their new community? Some have, some do, some don't. We need to be there to help them re-engage in that and keep that momentum going from where they came from. Because no doubt some of the reason the second and third and on generations are further removed may be because their parents who immigrated never got plugged in to a faith community when they resettled in wherever they in the United States. Or as we know too, even in the United States, they migrate around over time as well. Some settle in one area, but others move around. And like anybody, when they move, they either going to get re-plugged in or they're not. And that's true of all kinds of demographic groups, not just Hispanics. I read an article one time that I thought was really interesting about when you move into a new home yourself. And the statistic was you have about 90 days to meet all your neighbors. Statistically speaking, if in 90 days, the first 90 days, you don't meet your neighbors, you never will. Not so you won't know their names or meet them and say, hello, my name is so-and-so, but you'll never have a meaningful relationship with them. Because after 90 days, you're settled in, they're used to you being there, nothing's new anymore, and quite frankly, you'd get to be embarrassed to present yourself or introduce yourself, or I met him when I first moved in, I knew his name, but I never had him to my house for coffee or for a meal or a barbecue, and now I've forgotten his name, and I always wave at him, and I would be so embarrassed to walk over there and say, tell me your name again, I've been here for 6 months, I know we've met. So there's a window of opportunity that disappears pretty quickly. I mean, 90 days sounds like a lot, but it goes by like that. That's when you're moving. I know. I just moved into a house from a foreign country. You're like, man, not 2 years has flown by. And I've met a lot of my neighbors. I didn't quite meet them all like I should have. And I feel bad about that. I made some good relations with some of them. But I think you have the same thing at play here as these folks move in and they immigrate to a new community or as they migrate from community to community. If they don't get plugged in pretty soon after they move in, most of them never will. They'll get settled into a routine, settle into their house and their way of doing things. And they just the openness to that, to going to a new church or participating in a new faith community or a small group or whatever it is, will disappear pretty quickly. So we need to have folks who are there who are reaching out to those folks as they move in and saying from the get-go, saying, we have a faith community here. We'd love you to come and check us out. We'd love to come and participate with us. So then you have some more statistics about the foreign-born and their participation in religious services. About half say at least weekly. Again, same native-born, 31%. So it's going down. It's going down as they go through the generations. Now here in the bottom, I like this. These are interesting. 61% say that religion is very important in their lives. 24% somewhat important. So 75% would say somewhat or very important. Religion is somewhat or very important in their lives. And even 49%, almost half of those that self-report as religiously unaffiliated would still say that religion is important in their lives. So they're not participating actively in a community, a faith community, but they still recognize, at least philosophically or emotionally or whatever you want, how you want to put it, they recognize that religion is important, which means those are people who are very open to the gospel, very open to be invited to be a part of a faith community, but perhaps they're not being invited, or there's some other barriers that are there that are keeping them from expressing that, what they believe, what they self-report to believe. They're having trouble finding a motivation to have that lived out in their daily lives or express that in community with others. 69% of foreign-born Latinos report that religion is very important in their lives. Among the native-born, 49%. So again, it's going down. It's going down. It's going down. So we got to catch that at the front of the curve while we have a chance. And because no doubt if we can catch that immigrant population that's first arriving and get them plugged in and to a faith community, that second number for their kids is going to be a lot higher. Mm-hmm. It's going to be higher than 49%. It's going to be probably more on par with what their parents' outlook is on that kind of thing than the other folks in their community. Uh-oh, I hit the wrong button. My thumbs are kind of big for this little remote. So there's the area of opportunity of religion and faith, just in general. There's an openness to that. There's already a foundation of belief that we can exploit for the glory of God. More is an opportunity, I think, and again, Dan touched on some of this as well, is an area of marriage and family. And that's something I've had personal experience with in the Chilean community and believe a lot in, is that, you know, an area of opportunity, an area of a need. It's not only opportunity to be exploited, but it is a service that's needed. You know, beyond looking at, well, that sounds very cold and calculating. We're going to go exploit the need for marital help. But it's just a great service to the community. Every population in the United States needs it. We know the facts and figures, even within the church, are not good. But there's a strong trend in the Hispanic community. But there's also a great foundation. It's kind of the same thing as the area of faith and religion. You have a very strong foundation, a very strong inclination towards family, towards that kind of community. I was just in the house of a family that's new to our church in Irving, and I say this is a clan because we went to their house, their Salvadoran family, and they have six children, most of them are adult age. I think there's one teenager, and so three of those kids still live in the house. The other three kids live on the same street. Two of the aunts of the woman, two of her sisters live on the same street with their clan. So we're at their house for pupusas and other great food, and there were just people coming in and out the doors, this constant flow of folks coming through. And it was a very tangible example of the sense of family and community that those folks have in that community. And we had a great time. We spent, it was so much fun for my wife and I because, you know, gringos were so time-oriented, and we go to somebody's house for lunch, and we've had lunch, and it's been about an hour, so it's about time for you to go, isn't it? You know, it's all, we're done. It's an activity. We finished it, so it was fun. We'll do it again sometime, maybe. And probably not even in their house. We probably went to TGI Fridays or Chili's. They never invite you to their house. But in Chile, we love the hospitality of the Hispanic community, of the Chilean community. Always invite us to their home. We didn't go out to eat with people. We went to their home. And that doesn't happen so much in the United States. But it does, you know, when we got there with this family, And the reason we were meeting with them, we were considering starting a new small group with them that would be a bilingual small group. Because most of their family is bilingual. And it's a good example of what Dan's talking about. All these six kids, they're all English speakers. I mean, and speak perfect English. And they seem to prefer English. Or at least to do with us. Maybe maybe a reason they prefer English with me and not my have to deal with my broken Spanish. But we had a great time with them. And we just, you know, they were there at their house for like 5 hours. And we've only had to go because we had to pack to come to Pepperdine. So we really got to go now because we had to pack our bags for our trip the next morning. But it was so great to be with that family. And just that camaraderie and that sense of family is just so, so powerful in the Hispanic community. But I think it's something that, too, also starts to get lost at a pretty rapid pace as you go down the generations. Not a problem. This family hasn't lost it. But there are others that are becoming more and more disconnected and losing that quality as we go down the generations. So, again, we need to take advantage of that with the earlier immigrant generation, that they have such a powerful sense of family and such a feeling of unity among them. And this is what this guy was talking about. He was like, you know, he's a very strong believer, very faithful Christian. He's like, all he wants, all he can talk about is, I need my all of my family, not just all his kids are believers. But he said, you know, my sister-in-law, her family, they're not all believers, my neighbors. And he's like, they have all got to be believers. We got to evangelize this whole street, half of which are my family, and have them all in this small group we're going to start. I said, we have a problem, though, with just your family. We're not a small group. We're already a small church. And so if we invite anybody, I don't know, we're way beyond small group stuff. I don't know where we're going. But we'll see where God takes that. It's been interesting. Now, also along with that, so you have these strong sense of family. 8 of 10 agree family is the foundation of a healthy community. 7 of 10 agree a child is better off if his parents are married. 7 of 10 agree that the traditional definition of marriage is things that we politically struggle with, and it's part of the conversation today, is some of these things, especially about the traditional definition of marriage. The Hispanic community is right there with us on that subject, at least early on. Now, again, these numbers also, they change as you go through time. They become more for the good and the bad. The Hispanic community, as they go through the generations, become more acculturated or more assimilated, whichever term you prefer and want to use, depending on your context. And they start to drift in a lot of those areas towards a more liberal viewpoint or more open viewpoint that we wouldn't necessarily, as Christians, probably be in tune with. So again, we can help those families to maintain those values if we can get them plugged into the faith community and get them and share the gospel with them in powerful ways. 49%, about half, identified the breakup of the Hispanic family as an issue of great concern. And again, Dan touched on some of these things. 22% calling the most pressing issue. Dan's list is a good one. I think I got some of the stuff from that same list of he said there were 25, and he pointed out about 10 or so of the top concerns of the Hispanic community. That's where some of this stuff comes from. So they need some help. They're crying out for help with their families. They also see, I think, especially these first generation folks who have certain values, and they're alarmed and see what's happening to the subsequent generations, and they don't want that, but they need help in stopping that trend. It may not be enough in every case that just the patriarch or the matriarch of the family works to that end. They need some help from the local church and in their community to stop some of these trends of the breakup of the family. 69% of first-generation Latino children live in married couple families. And then the thing I found has a slight bump up in the second generation, but the third generation, it drops precipitously to 52% that they are. And then if you went on, you probably find that trend continuing. Or at some point, I'm sure it stabilizes, but it's a strong trend. So they need some help to keep their families together, keep their marriages together, keep their families together. And strongly related to that, you have youth issues, which, again, Dan mentioned, and some of the top ones, dropout from school, substance abuse, and teen pregnancy, all in the 60% area range of people self-reporting as these are great concerns to us as a Hispanic community. So how can we help with those things as churches? And the interesting thing is, I think there's, by the numbers, the Hispanic community is crying out for help from the church in these areas, but at the same time they're saying the church is not doing a good job at that. They are not. We need help and we're not being helped. We need resources, they're not being offered to us to help with our youth and family. 1 in 5 Hispanics think the churches and their communities are doing very well addressing challenges faced by Hispanic youth. 20% think that we're doing a good job as a church. And this is not the Church of Christ, it's just the church in general. But they don't see it. And we may think we're doing a good job with that. I think in some cases you go to a Hispanic church, and I know some, they say they've got a great little, relatively small, but a great youth group. And it may not even be small as a percentage of their congregation, it's small compared to the percentage of youth out in their community. And they're doing this, they're doing that. And this, again, happens in the dominant group, too. We think we're doing a great job with our youth. You know, are we really doing a great job with our youth? And even with our own, and are we doing a very good job at all with those who are outside our doors, reaching them and taking the gospel to them? They're saying we're not doing a good job, that the local church is not doing a good job. Hispanics rank Christian influencers, church programs for children and youth, and the Bible as last on the list of perceived influences on their children. So these are really low numbers. But then you go on, it says half or more say that those things are important. So they're saying they're important to us, but the local church is not doing a good job of, in the sense of exploiting that and that the importance we place on those things. We don't have, again, maybe hoping their family are doing something on their own initiative, but they need help. They need to be motivated by a community. They need the resources that community can offer to help with their kids and with their youth, to help stop some of these things, the dropout rate, the substance abuse rate, the teen pregnancy rate, and a litany of other things, gang participation, as Dan pointed out. These things all come along. So they're telling us through these studies what their needs are, and we got to find ways to meet them. And I would challenge any of you guys I work with in the Hispanic ministry, say, you've got to look at these things. These are powerful ways you can address the need in the Hispanic community and reach out to people and attract people by offering something that they need and that's useful to them that they need. And I think we probably in this room would all agree that, and this is our message in Chile, that the family is the foundational unit of society. It is the most important unit. If the family breaks down, eventually society will break down. So we look at the microcosm in a sense of the Hispanic community. It's true in that community. If the Hispanic community, the Hispanic family breaks down, the Hispanic community is going to break down. And as Dan pointed out, that's going to be increasingly a bigger deal to us across the spectrum in the United States. We can say, well, that's the Hispanic community's problem. It's about to be, it already is, but it's about to be even bigger, more so, all of our problem.
That's right.
All of our problem. Everybody limits gang violence and involvement in gangs. Well, again, as we've seen, Hispanics are largely youth are drawn to that if that's not headed off when they're younger. And that's a problem that affects the whole community. Didn't just affect the Hispanic community. And all those other things, the dropout rate, the substance abuse rate, pregnancy rate, those things all affect our broader community, whether we like it or not. It's not isolated in the Hispanic community. Some interesting challenges. A few minutes we have left, I'll talk about a couple of challenges I see and observe because we got about 2 minutes. One thing too, I think is, and this is especially true of gringos, probably a lot of people in this room are more aware of this and a little more sophisticated in their thinking about the Hispanic culture in the United States. But it's not monolithic. It's not homogenous. Within the Hispanic community, there is a lot of diversity of culture. And there's nationalistic issues between some of the folks from different places. Something I've had to learn. My only experience is with Chile. My only firsthand experience had been with Chile. And so I've been on a steep learning curve to learn more about the immigrant community in the United States and how they operate and what the dynamics are. And it's been really interesting to see how that plays out. And I'm still trying to figure out what that means for Hispanic ministry. Is it okay to send a Guatemalan into a predominantly Mexican community to evangelize? Is that going to work? Because I know that sometimes there's some historical tensions and cultural tensions there between those communities. I know our church in Fort Worth is largely a Mexican American population, and so in the soccer games, they're all rooting for Mexico, and the guy who's working there is Guatemala, and he just kind of keeps quiet. He says, "I don't say anything if they lose. I keep quiet. I don't say anything." Part of him is nationalistic tendency. He wants to go brag. And go, "Ha, look, you guys lost this, lost that." He's like, "I keep quiet. I'll get myself in trouble if I go raising Cain about the how Mexico lost this or that lost that." And when they win, he celebrates with them. By a margin of more than 2-1 across all the major demographic subgroups of Hispanics, more say U.S. Hispanics have many different cultures than say they share a common culture. So they self-report and self-identify as being very different from one another. But we, as gringos, probably most of us think, and we tend to, lump them all together.
Right.
And that has ramifications in ministry as well. And we don't necessarily, good gringos, we don't do that. We're well-intentioned. It's just we don't know any better because we don't see these figures. We don't communicate enough with this community to know they're not all the same. Now, I do think, that aside, we do hope that, theologically speaking, we can unite them under a super culture, the Christian culture in a lot of ways. And I think there's some ways which are legitimate to say the Christian culture supersedes any national or regional or linguistic or ethnic or racial or whatever culture you want to put on it that supersedes that. But it's very difficult to distinguish those things. And I know in Chile, I made mistakes in some of those areas. I learned with time. And I had to make adjustments to why. So this is something that goes beyond your Chilean culture or my gringo culture. This is something that's super cultural in the sense that it's the Christian culture. It's the right thing because it's what Christ, what he modeled for us, and it's what God expects of us. But you got to be careful walking that line, very, very careful walking that line, because they feel like they don't feel like they're necessarily a unified community in a lot of senses. Now, I've seen areas in some churches where they have become a unified community, even though they're different nationalities, and that speaks volumes about the power of the gospel. I've seen others where it appears that that's not the case, and there have been issues, and preachers run out of town, or this, or you know, groups that compete within one another within a church context, within a church congregation, because usually nobody comes out and says it's because of nationalities and differences, but I think in some cases it seems to be evidence to the point that that's part of the dynamic that's at play there. I'm going to skip this next one just to answer the time. And some of the things to talk about too, that this is some of the, maybe another area of opportunity that as first generation Hispanic churches we can exploit and use, and a lot of churches do with English ESL or LST, Let's Start Talking in English as a second language. Our church in Arlington has a big ESL program. They do in partnership with one of their supporting churches in the same city, and it's been very powerful and been a great tool to evangelize and reach folks in the community. But as a whole, the Hispanic community says, yes, we think it is important that we do learn English. And I know, it's a political hot potato sometimes about, hey, should we have two languages or not, or should we make them all learn English, and those things get thrown around. But even as a community, they self-identify saying, we do think it's important. I think it plays more into those things of acculturating, but opportunity for jobs and education, things like that. So that's an area we can help. If that help is being requested, I don't want to force anybody, that on anyone in the Hispanic community, that they learn English. But if they're saying they want it, and it's for their good, well, if we can help provide that service as a community that cares about them, then fantastic. Keep hitting that off button. Two areas of the thing I think are great is one, work ethic. I think that it's sometimes a stereotype. Sometimes a stereotype goes both ways. Sometimes we say a stereotype is Hispanics are hard workers. Sometimes we as gringos have the image they're lazy. I know we all know and laugh about sometimes, or sometimes don't laugh about the image of the guy under the cactus with his hat pulled down and sleep taking a nap. You know, these are stereotypes that we may have one or the other, depending on what our background is or context is. But I think that in general, they have a strong work ethic. Then that's good economically, commercially speaking, but it also is powerful for the church. And I've seen it firsthand. You go to these Hispanic churches, they're willing to do whatever. They work hard. They are much more active and much harder workers trying to reach the community and evangelize and serve the community than I oftentimes see in the dominant group churches. They tend to be a lot of them much more outward focused than some of our dominant group churches. So I think it's an area we say, hey, that's fantastic. God can use that work ethic for his glory and to reach that community. One that's an area of concern, and I experienced this firsthand in Chile. In fact, it was probably the biggest cultural shock element that I had to overcome, and it's one that was more nuanced and took me longer time to recognize than language and food choices and things like that, was the fact that this lack of confidence in your neighbor was rampant in Chile. It was amazing to me the prejudice they have against each other. Just anybody you didn't know was suspect just by default. And I know there's things, like in Chile, they had a political dictatorship for many years, and there's things that are historically and politically come into play there that built that cultural norm for them in that case. But it made the work so difficult. It's hard to tell your brother, Chilean brother, to go out and evangelize the other Chilean brother when he doesn't like him or trust him.
Right.
It's very difficult. And they're saying that self-identifying, Latino self-identifying, saying we don't trust people around us, basically. They're out to exploit us, get something from us, abuse us, whatever the reasons are. That's a big challenge in Hispanic work. If people don't trust each other in their neighborhood, it's hard to reach them with the gospel. Really hard. But it's one of the things where I think that's where Christian culture supersedes this aspect of the culture. We've got to break that down.
Amen.
Love your neighbor as yourself. You know? And I think being in Texas, maybe it's changing, but as a Texan, we tend to be, and the Chileans were amazed. Scott, they're taking advantage of you. What are you doing? You're so naive. You gringo, you don't know what you're doing. Because I said, hey, my philosophy is I'd rather trust somebody first until they prove me otherwise, that they can't be trusted. That's just I think some of that's Texan, and I think influenced by the Christian culture as well. Whereas Chileans had the opposite approach. I don't trust you at all until you can prove that you're trustworthy, and then you better prove it over and over again, and you better not slip up even once, because if you do, then you're out. That's how they operated. And it was very difficult for me to adjust to that or, you know, understand that. But it's a challenge for us, even in the U.S. Hispanic community. If they don't trust one another, it's really hard. It's going to be real. That's a huge barrier to overcome, probably bigger than a lot of other barriers that are much more tangible. It's a much more nuanced barrier, but it exists, and we have to understand that. So, just to finish up, thank you for your time. I think that sometimes we hear, political rhetoric, that we have this Hispanic challenge. What are we going to do with the Hispanic challenge in the United States with the immigrant challenge, all these challenges? And I think we as Christians have to reframe that and use different language, because the way we speak affects the way we think and the way we do. I think we say, what do we do with the Hispanic opportunity? There's a tremendous opportunity out there before us. And quite frankly, as a brotherhood, Church of Christ, we are way behind the curve, like we often are on lots of things, I think. We're way behind the curve. There are lots of other groups, and Dan knows this from his research. You read his book. All his examples are not Churches of Christ, because we've not done a good job at this. We've been very slow to get to the table on this, and so we're behind, way behind. And so we got a lot of catching up to do. But I think that the awareness level is rising quickly among Churches of Christ. I think there's a lot more interest in this. And I thank you guys for being here, because you're showing your interest. I know you guys represent ministries and churches that are interested. So please, guys, take this back home, wherever that is for you, and promote this, that we have got to take advantage of the opportunity in the Hispanic community around us, and we've got to do something. And we've got to do it with open hearts, with good hearts, with good intentions, and do things not only to evangelize, but do things that really impact the community where their needs are, with their marriages and their families, with their youth, and these other things that they need help with. We can help them. And we can help them, and that's a way to show Christ to them that they will respond to. Thank you so much for your time. Again, there's stuff at the back. Please don't forget tomorrow.